live to live righteously.
It's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. It's episode number 322, wherein we talk to Jackson Washburn. He's a young member of the church who is from Arizona, who recently returned from having served as a missionary in Armenia. Jackson has participated in a variety of public and online forums where he's been able to share his beliefs and has been involved in interfaith advocacy and dialogue since his early high school career. He's currently studying religious studies down at Arizona State University. His passions include reading, writing, poetry, traveling, learning languages, defending the gospel, engaging in interreligious conversations, and I think his girlfriend is also another passion. Thank you for being here, Jackson.
Oh, geez. You got that right.
Yeah, you can't deny it, but you also can't indulge it either, Jackson.
Yeah, very true, very true.
Glad to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Yep, no, thank you. I appreciate it.
So let's start right where I introduced you at, which is you're recently home from serving a mission. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, that's true, and I would be remiss if I didn't caveat that by saying that I'm home a bit shorter than I anticipated. I served my mission for 8 months, and so it wasn't the full 2 years that I was anticipating. But luckily, the call anticipates, you know, things like this as well.
Sure.
I spent a happy 6 months in Armenia and then 2 months in the Provo MTC.
Now, you're not the first Armenian missionary who has been here in the Cultural Hall.
Oh, really?
His name is Paul Perrin. He was one of the first missionaries that served in Armenia. He's now a professor at Notre Dame in Indiana, and he came on and sort of shared his story. So people are a little bit familiar with that. But what did you – you had some sort of not necessarily concerns, but it took you a little bit to decide to go on a mission. Start there.
Yeah, certainly. Well, one thing is that I was raised for the most part in an interfaith household. When I was 12, my mom experienced a change of faith where she became an evangelical Christian, moving from being raised a member of the church herself. And so I was raised in both faith communities throughout my teenage. And so both the choice to serve a mission, but also just my general testimony took some time to develop during my high school years. Sometimes that was a bit of a struggle. But yes, it did take some time, and I didn't go on a mission right after high school. I chose to stay and do a year of college at ASU first. For those who have known me online, maybe it felt like a long time coming, but I was finally able to go out on a mission. I was very happy about that, and especially where I was able to serve, I'm very grateful for the opportunity I was able to have.
So you talk about your family. You say mom sort of transitioned to an evangelical Christian. Did dad remain a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Yes, he did. They remained married as well. Eventually they divorced, but not on religious grounds. But for quite a few years, we did have an interfaith family where me and my siblings would either switch off every week which church we would go to, or because I'm kind of a religious studies nerd, I would just go to both every Sunday. So... that was kind of my high school life.
How was that situation for you? I know that's not easy for certainly your parents to navigate, but it's a different dynamic for kids to navigate as well.
Yeah, well, I was lucky to have parents that were very supportive. Before that big change, before my mom experienced a faith transition, I remember very clearly both of my parents from an early age raising me and telling me that, yes, we are Latter-day Saints. We're members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But if you ever choose down the road to be something different, if you, you know, in your journey decide something else is better for you, we're going to love you the same. We're going to respect you. We're going to support you. And I think that kind of framework that was already established in my family growing up helped my mom's transition a bit, because like I said, my parents didn't separate because of that or anything. They were as supportive as they could. There were some complexities and some tensions at times on religious grounds, but they were able to kind of work through those. And it did require kind of a change of the family dynamic just a little bit. We had to make space for each other. We had to approach the topic of religion a little bit differently in our conversation with each other and in our practice. But like I said, we still loved each other. And so yeah, there were some complications, some friction at times, but there was a lot of love. But you know, to be honest, even with that kind of supportive environment, it still was difficult for me. During that time, I actively researched different kinds of literature about church history, about church doctrine and belief, and just Christianity in general, lots of different religions. And there was times in my search where the literature I would read or the kind of arguments that I'd familiarize myself with would be pretty critical about the church, its founders, its leaders, history. And it took some time to work through those. There's times where I didn't know if I was too much of a fan of Joseph Smith. I don't think I had the best feelings towards him, but you know, doggone it, like I could not help but feel the utmost solidarity with him, because he too was once a young teenager who didn't know which church was true, but was desperately trying to figure it out. And so I always felt like I had that in common with him, even when I couldn't say that I really liked him. Now, I very much love Joseph Smith and have a testimony of the kind of prophet that he claimed to be. But yeah, there was times where that solidarity, that kind of similarity that I felt with him. Yeah, it was funny. It was one of the few things that kept me going, that kept me really hooked on him, because I felt like he was one of the few people that could get me.
Did you have this religious curiosity before the rift in your parents' faith tradition?
You know, I can't say that I necessarily did. I've always loved history. I've gravitated towards the humanities, right? So naturally, religion does fall under that category. But before that point, I had never really been exposed to a lot of other religions. I'd never taken the time to really talk and get to know people of other faiths or attend their places of worship or read their scriptures. So certainly after that transition, that catalyzed what turned out to be a major passion about my life. I joke and say that one of the requirements for someone who's going to date me is that they really need to be able to handle how religious that I am, both for studying religion, but also just in general, because it's a major part of my life, and I don't know if a relationship could work if someone wasn't down for that.
So kudos to your girlfriend
Oh
already.
yes. No, that'll let you know that things are going well with us.
That's awesome. That's
Yeah.
great. So you mentioned in the bio that you sent me that this interfaith in your high school years, does this mean that you're trying to build bridges between the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and other churches, or finding your own path with that, or what?
Probably all of the above, to be honest. You know, so I was actively researching and trying to press forward in my own spiritual journey by reading, by talking to people of their faiths, by attending their places of worship. But I also did engage in interfaith advocacy. One thing I was able to do in my high school years was found and organize several interfaith student groups. The organization was called the World Religion and Tolerance Society. We were able
Awesome.
to establish that in three high schools in two different states. And I would later be able to speak at multiple different large venues, such as the Parliament of the World's Religions in
Wow.
Salt Lake City in 2015, the United Nations, several other interfaith conventions and conferences, and I've been able to hold positions of leadership in different interfaith organizations since then. So it's been something that I've been very active with, and it's constant, like it constituted a lot of my free time. That was kind of the extracurricular stuff I was involved in high school.
Give me an idea. How old are you now?
I'm 20.
Okay. So, this decision to serve a mission, what did that look like? You said it took you a year plus to figure it out. So,
Yeah,
tell me about that journey.
my faith journey, when I think of kind of the years that I would deem as like years of active faith crisis or you know, the more intense phase of my journey, I would still say, of course, I'm on a journey right now, and you know, my views are still developing and changing in different ways as I mature and experience more life. But really between the age of 12 and 16, that's when I was actively debating whether or not I would identify as a Latter-day Saint or a non-denominational Christian or maybe something else, right? Mm-hmm. So it was in those years that I was actively trying to find a testimony of the church and of the restored gospel. And once I, around the age of 16, when I became very comfortable identifying as Latter-day Saint, when I felt like I had a testimony of the Restoration, the Book of Mormon, and several other important facets of our belief, that's when I felt compelled to serve a mission as well. And really, it just came down to the fact that I have always wanted to serve people both physically and spiritually. And I feel like a mission is the most powerful way or one of the most powerful and unique ways within our faith tradition where young people are able to go out and dedicate 2 years of their life to doing so. So that's why I felt compelled to serve a mission was because I just wanted to help people no matter how I could.
So you said right around like 16, 17. So then from that time until serving, it was always a, I know I'll go, but the time is not yet.
Yeah, right. Of course, I had to graduate high school.
Sure.
And
that silly thing, right?
Yeah, right. So glad that's over. but yes, once I graduated, of course, the decision was whether or not to serve then or to wait a year. And I just felt compelled to wait a year. I felt like it would be good so that I could mature a bit more, so I could experience school. And I don't know. It's just kind of the path that I chose. I almost sound like that was a weird decision to make, but it's just so ingrained in our culture at times to go right out of high school. I really think it might be better for the norm to be to, you know, go at 19 or 20, unless you specifically feel compelled to go at 18. Right. Even though I frame it in kind of an opposite sense.
I'm sort of the mind that you should go when you feel like it. And if it's,
yeah, exactly.
You know, if it's
exactly.
18, if it's 21, if it's 23, you know,
for sure.
If it's when you're older, like I'm sort of the mind that you should really, really, because it's hard. You should really,
yeah, no, you
should
got,
really
you gotta make
feel
sure
it.
you're serving at the right time. And you got to make sure you're serving for the right reasons too, and not just because of expectations or pressure of some sort of or another.
So I want to pick up a question real quick that I didn't ask you. So how long have you been home then from your mission?
I got home on Friday. So
a week ago.
Yeah, essentially a week ago.
Okay. Now I want to get back to my other questions. I just wanted to give people that context of what that time what that timeline looked like.
Right.
So you feel like it's best to have waited a year. Now, in retrospect, do you feel like it was good that you went to that year of college before you left?
No, absolutely. I'm very glad I made that decision.
How come?
I was able to open up opportunities for myself during that year that I don't think I would have been able to have had otherwise.
Like what?
Different maybe interfaith positions, different educational passions or pursuits.
Meet your girlfriend in that time, Jackson?
Yes, I did meet my girlfriend during that time too. But but primarily I do think I was able to experience a lot of growth during that time. I was able to mature quite a bit.
Sure.
And I think that very much assisted me on my mission. I'm grateful that I...
You went away to Arizona State. Are you from down there?
Yeah, I live in Gilbert.
Okay, so did you live at home in that time?
I lived on campus.
Okay. So you really did get that away from home, but close enough to home experience.
Yeah, for sure. And that very, very much helped being able to leave the nest to a fair extent.
So I want to take a break for a quick second. And when we come back in the second block of the Cultural Hall, I want to pick up, you get the call to Armenia, and then I want to go through all that. All right?
Okay, sounds great.
We'll do that coming up in the second block of the Cultural Hall. I want to take a quick second and talk to you about Best DJ in Utah now in its second year. Last year, I went to Washington, to Roche Harbor, and did a gorgeous wedding. This year, I'm slated to go to Moab, to go to Denver to do weddings. And guys, it couldn't be going any better. Thanks in large part to folks like yourself, people who are listening to this and say, you know what, I need a wedding or a mobile DJ for something, and then reach out to me. You can go to bestdjinutah.com. You can find me on all of the social medias at Richie T. Stedman, or you can certainly just send me an email, Richie, R-I-C-H-I-E-T as in tough guy, Stedman, S-T-E-A-D-M-A-N, @gmail.com. I would love to see what I could do to make your event that much better. Whether it's a party or the biggest day of your life, you need the best DJ in Utah. And like I said, it doesn't have to be in Utah. It can just be the best DJ in Utah. I don't know. Now we start to get into like the technical things. It's bestdjinutah.com.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
All right, here in the second block of the Cultural Hall, remember, if you like conversations like this, you can always do what Ezra did to recommend this episode. You can just message us on Facebook and say, hey, you know what? I have this really great story. If it's your story or someone's story that you know, you can pass it along, and we'd love to share it with everybody else. We're on all the social medias. Wherever we're at, it's always at the Cultural Hall, so you can find us there. Message us. If you like this or other episodes, please feel free to tell us that in a message, too. It's great to hear. Enjoyed a story, or that a story changed your life, or even if a story made you mad for some, like to hear that things. So where we left off, Jackson, was you get the call. Now, when you got the call, it's not like these fangled new callings now that come over the computer. You got a paper envelope, correct?
Yeah, no, I was still in the Stone Age.
So what is it like? You open it up and boom, Armenia.
Yeah, right. So I was at the church because that was some nice neutral ground rather than one of my parents' homes. Mm. But we had quite a few people there, different ward members, friends. So I did feel quite a bit of support with that. But yes, I opened my call. And I read off the Armenia, Georgia mission. And I mean, there is just a whole uproar of applause and excitement from everyone. I was certainly shocked. I had to explain to my mom that I was not serving in the state of Georgia, in the city of Armenia, but rather the country of Armenia and, you know, next to the country of Georgia.
Right.
You know, I had to show her the map where Armenia is bordering Iran and is basically in the Middle East. And, you know, so that that definitely concerned her.
Yeah.
She had to learn to feel comfortable with that. But I was just so excited to be able to get called to that mission. Immediately, I felt a confirmation that that's where I was meant to serve, that it was an inspired call. And I was just completely elated to receive the news of that.
Armenian is a difficult language to learn. Talk about that experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm conversational in Armenian now. I still have plenty of room to improve, of course, and I want to continue my studies in Armenian. But my experience in learning it, I have a background in learning other languages. So I've studied Arabic and Mandarin and Greek and Spanish and some other languages.
Wow.
And so I'm fairly used to different tips and tricks of how to practice and learn a language for yourself. One thing I love about Armenian is its alphabet system. I think its alphabet is very beautiful. It can look kind of overwhelming at times because mm-hmm. some of the letters look similar to each other. They have 39 letters in their alphabet. But it really, when you're writing it, it has just a very beautiful, very flowing feel to it. And the alphabet is phonetic. So everything is spelt the way it should be. It's not like English where the only rule is that there aren't any rules. As far as the language goes, there's definitely some differences with English. There's some different sounds that they have, like the kha and the ra and, you know, different things that it makes it sound like you're clearing your throat. So it can sound a little rough like that, but I really do think it's a beautiful language. And it wasn't too difficult to pick up, especially since I was surrounded in an environment where other people were constantly speaking it to me. So yes, it was difficult at times, but it was a fun challenge, I think.
What about the country? What about the country as far as the work goes, as far as just the living goes?
Yeah. So one of the most important things to understand about Armenia is its geographical location. That's going to tell you a lot about what to expect there. It's at the crossroads, basically, of Eastern Europe, of the Middle East, of Asia. And so it has this kind of infusion of different cultures where it's really interesting to see all of them blend into each other. And as far as the country goes, I'm absolutely in love with the country of Armenia. It has such beautiful geography, landscape, just natural scenes where I just haven't seen that level of beauty matched in the States. And so I was very grateful to be able to travel around most of Armenia. I went as far down south as possible in the mission, as well as far north as possible. So I was able to cover quite a bit of ground in the different areas that I either directly served in during my transfers or I went on splits in. The people there are incredibly hospitable. I don't think I've seen that level of hospitality matched anywhere. It's one of the things they really pride themselves on. Another thing that's incredibly important is that Armenia was the first country in the world to officially adopt Christianity as their state religion.
Interesting.
They did this in 301 AD. And so they have the world's longest, most ancient heritage of consistent Christianity in their country. And so you'll find churches and monasteries and these stone crosses called Khachkars, and just all kinds of ruins and relics that date back centuries and centuries. And the entire land just has a very ancient and a very, frankly, sacred feel to it because of that. The people there have been professing the name of Christ longer than basically anyone else in the world. And so their faith is very old. It's very ancient. And it's something that I respect, and I was very moved by during my time of service there.
And for a religious nerd like yourself, you probably ate every bit of that
up.
Oh,
yeah. No, I was in paradise, man.
Tell me about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Armenia.
Right. So the church has been there for a couple decades now, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union. But growth has been somewhat slow. It is in Eastern Europe, and so you can expect kind of similar growth rates. Officially, there's a little more than 3,000 members of the church in Armenia, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
As far as activity rates go, of course, those are lower. But we do have some pretty promising branches throughout the country. We have some very strong families, some strong saints that are present there. And so the church is growing, albeit slowly. And I think it's moving towards an increasingly favorable position in the country.
Were you able to teach many people or have anyone enter the waters of baptism in the time that you spent there?
Yeah, so there should be one lady that I was able to teach that either got baptized a few days ago or is getting baptized in the next few days. I'm going to have to reach out to some of the elders there that I served with to see if that went through. Directly during my time, no, I wasn't able to personally baptize anyone. But I should, once this woman is baptized, I hope she is. That'll be my one. I'll count that. I was able to teach quite a few people. One thing that's nice, because of the kind of universal acceptance of Christ in the country of Armenia, everyone loves to talk about Jesus Christ.
Right.
It's very easy to be able to get into conversations on matters of faith with people. Because if you recognize that they believe in Christ and you make it clear that you do as well, you'll be able to have some great conversations with them. Of course, it'll be difficult to maybe convince someone to change churches.
Sure.
And that's because the Armenian Apostolic Church is kind of the more or less the state religion of Armenia. They have a very ancient and special status in the country, and that's what the vast majority of Armenians belong to. And because they tie their religious identity so deeply in with their ethnic identity as Armenians, a lot of times they feel friction or like they would be betraying their heritage if they were to change religions in some way. So that's a difficulty that can slow the work somewhat.
Yeah.
But the people there are very open to talking about Christ, and that's a huge strength that they have. I was very moved by their faith.
Armenia is also unique in that the church established a stake in 2013 and then disbanded the stake in 2016. What do you know about
that? That is true. And that's not something we typically talk a whole lot about, at least in the mission itself.
Right.
And I'm not privy to all the details about why that happened. But I do feel like it was the right decision that needed to be made. Just in order to establish a better infrastructure for what the church needed. We're building it back up to the point where, in the future, I have the full confidence that a stake will be present there and it'll be strong and the church will be thriving. But yes, there were different variables that went into making that decision. And I believe that was only the second time in church history where a country's only stake had to be disorganized.
Yeah, with the first one being in Liberia back in 2007.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, luckily with Liberia, they got a stake back in about 5 years. So I think we're getting close to when we could get to that point again, too. So it is something that sometimes there's some tender feelings struck with that in the country. And so people don't talk about it a whole lot. But I'm very hopeful that with the faith of the saints that I was able to witness there, that they'll have a stake again in no time.
Is it, I'm just going to pry a little bit more. Was it leadership issues? You talk about kind of infrastructure. Was it that the church wasn't being run correctly, or what were you privy to?
From what I understand, it was more just the need to have a priesthood structure.
Okay.
And so there was a need to have more priesthood leaders. And when it was understood that the stake that was set up didn't have that kind of support system it needed with individuals who held the priesthood. Individuals felt it necessary to make the decision to disorganize it temporarily. Yeah.
It's a fascinating story, especially when you consider its uniqueness with only happening one other time.
Right.
Within the history of the church, especially being that one stake within the country. I'm sure that there have been multiple stakes that have been, as you put it, disorganized or mm-hmm. Disbanded or, eliminated
for sure,
or whatever.
For sure.
But, so talk about the 6 months in country, the 8 months on mission. What did you learn? What did you experience?
Well, luckily I can look back and say that I learned or I became or grew in all the ways that I wanted to during my mission. So I feel very successful in that sense that the things that before I served, I wanted to be able to accomplish or feel like I reached that point. Now I feel like I got to that point.
What are those things?
So I really wanted to be able to look back and say that I was able to live more selflessly, that I was able to love people more deeply, that my testimony of Christ and his gospel was able to be strengthened, that I really felt confident in the service that I rendered, where I felt like I gave it my best and I dedicated and consecrated my time to the Lord. And that now I just feel like a better disciple because of that, a much better disciple. So in those ways, I feel like my mission was very successful, even though it was a different amount of time than maybe I anticipated in starting.
Second to the decision to serve a mission, I think the second most difficult decision would be that decision to come home.
Right.
So talk about that.
Yeah. Essentially, I've just been experiencing some concerns since April or so where I felt the need to reach out to some church-sponsored therapists. The church in Armenia, I believe the closest therapist that they have is in Ukraine. So he's several countries away.
Mm-hmm.
And so those conversations I was able to have with him were over phone. But of course, missions, I didn't go into one naive at all. I understand that, especially nowadays, concerns along emotional health lines, such as anxiety or depression or things like that, seem to be on an increase. I have a little bit of susceptibility to that, just in my family.
Uh-huh.
And so that was something that I was sensitive to going in. So I've always tried to stay on top as much as I can of my own, personal mental, emotional health.
Uh-huh.
And, there just began to be some concerns along the lines of depression, anxiety, things like that. where as I continued to reach out for help, it didn't seem like the situation was improving. It seemed to be getting worse, right? And it got to the point where I felt the need that it would be in my best interest, health-wise, to experience a change in environment and return home.
That's a big decision, and I think a lot of people maybe wouldn't do that. Maybe would continue, you know, at maybe their own harm to continue to serve just because of the stigma that unfortunately exists around those that come home, even, you know, a month or 2 months early. Talk about the ultimate decision to come home. What did you feel as you made that decision? What have you felt as you came home? What have people said to you? Tell me all about that experience.
Yeah, well, I can say as far as at least like 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago, I didn't have plans on coming home early. I was still planning on being in Armenia for 2 years. So this is something that happened very recently where I did actually plan on, I don't want to say like toughing it out, but trying to continue serving for as long as I could, right? I really wanted to do those 2 years. But there was a kind of a paradigm shift that I had after a particular experience where I felt personally impressed that it would be in my best interest to return home. And of course, during this process and some of the things that I felt like I was struggling with, I would naturally ask myself, like, why me? Why is this happening to me? I remember on one of the drives to the mission home, where I was asking myself that and kind of being involved in some intense personal prayer and internal contemplation, I felt a very strong witness from the Spirit, where a line from my patriarchal blessing came into my mind, which kind of paraphrased, just explains that the things in this life that I will experience, I'll be able to understand why I'm called to experience those things. And in going through that, it made me remember times in my life where I've gone through difficult times, such as with my parents' divorce or other occasions where, you know, it was very difficult for me. But because I went through those experiences later, I was able to use what I had learned from those things. I was able to take how the ways that I had grown, and I was able to more effectively minister to other people. And so I'm hoping that with this decision to come home, that I'll be able to minister in ways that I don't yet understand. But that was one thing that gave me a lot of peace in the moment and made me feel like it was right for me to come home. Another thing was some experiences with my mission president, where I was able to receive a blessing for him. And there's just different circumstances or different things that happened that, again, reaffirmed or impressed upon me the need for me to return home for whatever reason. And right now I can't say that I exactly understand or know why I felt the need to do that. But I do believe that it was an inspired decision, and it wasn't something that I considered lightly.
If it isn't inappropriate for me to ask, I would be curious to know that experience that you were like, nope, I need to.
Well, yeah, no, it was basically the one with the Spirit that I just shared with
you're
you.
You're talking, so it was that experience with the patriarchal blessing and the contemplating of that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the way that you phrased it out, I was like, is that the experience? Or okay.
Yeah, I don't know. My apologies.
No, you're fine.
That,
you're fine.
Yeah, that was in the same moment where I just really felt like, oh my gosh, like maybe this is something that I need to do. And then as I was exploring that, that's when I kind of had a confirming witness of it.
So parents, what did they say?
Very supportive. And I knew that wouldn't be an issue. And I feel very grateful because of that. They, of course, supported me going out on a mission. And they just as quickly supported me in coming back from a mission. So I feel very blessed to have a family where the kind of stigma that you mentioned, I don't feel is present. And I've been overwhelmed with the amount of support that I've received, both from friends and family, but then also from kind of the online community that I've been able to be a part of. Everyone's been very supportive about that. And I'm very grateful for that.
It's an interesting dynamic with your girlfriend too. What was her response?
Oh, well, she was very grateful. So
Okay, that's it. Perfect. All right. Yeah, no, she's grateful to have you back.
Yeah, she the same way, she was supportive of me going, but well, she's definitely not complaining that I came home early. So
have there been negative experiences?
Not yet. No, I don't think so. Like I said, everyone's been very kind to me. And I've actually been able to have quite a few different opportunities come up where some blessings have already manifested themselves in my life where I feel very grateful for those things. I feel like I'm being able to hit the ground running and just again throw myself into things that I'm passionate about upon returning. So in my mind, yes, like I only served a formal mission for 8 months, but of course, I intend on consecrating the rest of my life to the Lord in a way that can be just as sacred or holy as a mission can be. So that's my intention, is to not see this as kind of like a lapse in responsibility, but just a change in location, perhaps, and a change in some of the things that I'm involved with, but ultimately for the same purpose of ministering to others, both physically and spiritually.
When I asked if you had experienced anything negative, you said not yet, which unfortunately you can't control how speak, behave, and all those things. Aside from what you have already done, which is, you know, you consecrated your life to the Lord, continued to just pick up right where you left off when you left and further the work that you did out there. Are there other things that maybe someone listening to this who is in a similar situation, things that you're doing that you're like, you know, I know that there's potential that there could be someone saying something negative about it, and this is how I've prepared for it?
Well, of course, I was sensitive or aware of the fact that not everyone would be charitable to the decision to return home early.
Are you speaking about people back home or people there in Armenia?
Oh, no, people back home. Okay. Like we've identified, there is a stigma at times. I think it's decreasing in how often it occurs, but certainly there's still plenty of times where there's individuals who might not have the same support or positive reception by their family or friends or ward members as I've experienced thus far. And with that, I'm still prepared for people to maybe not be so understanding, but I would just like to direct my comments to individuals who maybe know people who have returned home early or mm-hmm. just in the future, you'll get to know people. There's several important things that have made a difference in my experience. One of the biggest ones that I'm still so grateful for is when people validate my experience on a mission and describe it in the same terms as someone who has served a full 2 years, using the terms like honorable or mm-hmm. things like that, right? Mm-hmm. That's a term that we throw out a lot. I don't know if we always understand it, but things like that, they mean a lot to me because, like I said, I didn't intend on coming home early. I left with the full intention of staying the full 2 years. And I feel like the reasons I had to come home weren't in my control, that they the things that I was experiencing, maybe struggling with, they weren't just they certainly weren't caused by me. So it was a curveball that I had to roll with. So for the people who have been able to support me by recognizing that, by affirming the hard work that I was able to put into a mission and frame it in the same way as they would any other mission, that's definitely made the difference for me. I'm so grateful for that. And I know for a fact that that can make the difference with the experience of other early return missionaries. So I would just encourage those listening to be as empathetic as you possibly can to those who might be experiencing a change of plans on their mission for one reason or another. Affirm the hard work that they've put into it and recognize that, you know, it's anticipated that you'll serve for 1.5 to 2 years. Uh-huh. You know, it's not guaranteed. And so I trust personally that the Lord has other plans for me, and that there's other ways where I can contribute to the building up of his kingdom and help the work move forward.
I like that you use the language from the mission call, which is it is anticipated that you will serve, but
right.
You know, you may not. And guess what?
Exactly.
And guess what? Great for you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to take a break for a second. And when we come back, I want to talk in the third block about interfaith advocacy, what we as members of the church can do to better foster connections with members in our community, whatever faith that may be. I want to talk about certainly what we could do in the state of Utah, but abroad as well. And we'll do that coming back in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Okay.
Hi, friends. Dan the Laptop Man here from PC Laptops. I get a lot of emails with feedback from customers. Here's one. Dear Dan, I want to thank you for the help you gave my mom with her computer. She's gone from being frustrated to fascinated. I'm not overjoyed, though, that every picture of me that she has is now on Facebook. But she loves the computer and is happier than I've seen her in her whole life because of your team. You guys are the best. Signed, Happy. Dear Happy, in our company training meetings, we always teach everyone to treat every customer like they're your mom. At PC Laptops, we'll hold your hand every step of the way. Get a brand new PC Laptops desktop for just $799 with a lifetime warranty at any PC Laptops location. $799? You can't beat that. While supplies last, quantities are highly limited. Please visit us at PCLaptops.com. That's PCLaptops.com. I know you'll be happy too. Hey, Ma!
Time for the third block of the Culture Hall. And remember, if you love the stuff that you're hearing, you can always become a Patreon subscriber and become a part of that secret book or secret Facebook group. It's not sacred. It's just secret that you can't be a part of unless you become a Patreon subscriber. You can go to patreon.com/theculturalhall. And as little as $1 a month gets you to be interacting with other, what I like to call, super fans of the Cultural Hall. Again, patreon.com/theculturalhall. If you need me to send you a link, you can just message me on any of the social medias at the Cultural Hall. All right, Jackson, interfaith advocacy, a thing that we need to be better at. Agreed?
Yeah, I completely agree.
How can we do
that? Well, first, I think it'd be helpful to kind of define interfaith advocacy and what that looks like.
Do it.
Of course, advocacy is a bit of a strong word. But I think that can manifest itself in many different ways. In my life, what my interfaith relationships have looked like is just reaching out to people that are of different worldviews or religious traditions than myself, trying to understand them, engaging in dialogue with them. This is something, because we live in a pluralistic society, we already do and we take for granted, right? Naturally, we talk to people who aren't members of our faith community. Although maybe sometimes in Utah that can be a little hard, but there you will inevitably run into someone in your life that is not of the same belief that you are. Mm-hmm. And when you interact with them, even if you're not talking about religion, you're still engaging in a kind of interreligious contact with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so once you understand that, and we don't take that for granted, you really recognize how crucial it is to be able to engage in interfaith relations, whether it's verbal communication, whether it's service, cooperation. There's many ways where we can grow in unity with one another through shared understanding, shared values. So in my life, I have made an attempt to reach out to people of different faiths or worldviews, and I seek to understand them. I ask them questions about who they are and what they believe in. And this is something that as Latter-day Saints, we certainly appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's many times where we don't feel like we're given a voice to share who we are. We desire to show that we're normal people too. You know, even though at times we are peculiar,
right.
We care about the same things as many other people. We have families, you know, we have jobs, we have educations, we have a way of worship and a way that we live our lives. And that's something that's very personal and very dear to us. And when that's mishandled or misunderstood or kind of rejected, it can hurt, right? And
yeah.
So the best courtesy that we can do is to extend to other people the same kind of understanding that we would want to be extended to us. It's really just part and parcel of living the golden rule.
But that is so hard for some people.
Yeah, for sure. Because what do you do when maybe you strongly disagree on religious grounds or Maybe you disagree about politics or something like that. These values of communication, of conflict resolution, of building relationships across lines of difference, they're certainly not just restricted to religion, although that's something that I've focused on. Those values of communication really permeate throughout all areas of our life. And it's just part of what it means to be a good human, you know, a good mm-hmm. neighbor. Mm-hmm. So it's something that the church certainly values. We, as a church, have been involved in many different interfaith relationships and kind of cooperative relationships and projects for years. And it's something that we emphasize, the importance of religious liberty. Heck, it's even in our articles of faith that we believe that, you know, that we claim the privilege of worshiping Almighty God according to the dictates of our own conscience, mm-hmm. conscience, and allow all men the same privilege. Let them worship how, where, or what they may. That's in the 11th article of faith.
Yeah.
So that should tell you how important these values are to our belief system.
I have to tell you, just a quick aside, I'm pretty impressed that you didn't have to sing that article of faith to be able to quote it exactly.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't exactly quoting it. I was reading it off. So,
good for you.
I'm sorry. I had to be honest there. No, well, but the church and others have identified several areas where we can increase the efficacy of our interfaith relations with other people. And I want to share an example from Christer Stendahl. He's the Lutheran Bishop of Stockholm and a professor emeritus of Harvard Divinity School. He's someone who had a great relationship with the church. Unfortunately, he's passed now, but he has advocated during his life three different rules for religious understanding. So I'll just share them now. He says, number one, when you're trying to understand another religion, you should ask the adherents of that religion and not its enemies.
Right. Interesting.
And that's something that certainly members of the church will appreciate, because I've heard it said so many times that, well, why would you turn to critical literature or people who aren't members of the church in order to understand how we live and what we believe? Why wouldn't you come straight to the source and ask us? And I forget which apostle said it, one of the current members of the 12 has been on record saying that trying to understand the church from its detractors is like trying to learn about Christ from Judas.
Interesting.
You know,
like, interesting.
Why would you go to like a critical source or a secondhand source when you can easily go to a firsthand source? So I would encourage everyone, if you want to learn about Islam, if you want to learn about Judaism, if you want to learn about Buddhism or different faith groups or worldviews, why don't you seek out and find an individual who represents and occupies that kind of sphere of identity and belief and ask them yourself? Because the answers that you'll receive, I think, will be far more meaningful than the potential secondhand resources that you could access. Of course, secondhand resources can be very valuable as well, but certainly don't ever just allow them to be a substitute for quality firsthand relationships that you can foster. So the second principle is, don't compare your best to their worst.
Right.
It's something that's very easy. Unfortunately, I'll just throw out this example. It's far too easy. And I see this all the time in the news or online, where people will be quick to point out the terrorists or extremists of another religion. So let's say Islam, and compare it with the values that Christ advocated, right?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, those are very different comparisons. If you were to compare Christian extremists with Islamic extremists, you'd actually find a lot of similarities. But the point is that don't set up unfair comparisons where you are comparing apples to oranges, where you're comparing two totally different things in a manner that really isn't charitable. The charitable thing is to recognize that there's good in each community, that all of us, including our own church, has had times where people have made mistakes, where leaders have made mistakes, where the history can be messy, where individuals can succumb to all kinds of temptations or evils. But that we shouldn't allow that to taint and pollute our understanding of what people who actually practice and live that belief system look like, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, heaven knows that there's plenty of members of the church that don't espouse the values of their faith as best as they should. But I would really hope that, you know, at least for outsiders, that just as I wouldn't want those people to be shown as the face of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I would hope that we wouldn't do the same for other faith communities as well.
Agreed.
So again, it's a extending charity, that kind of golden rule mentality.
What's
the third one is leave room for holy envy. It's kind of an interesting term because we would think that how could envy be something that's holy? But he explains it as the act of finding elements in other faiths to emulate or appreciate. So for instance, when you engage in interfaith communication or dialogue, service, things like that, when you understand that you have shared common ground with other traditions, you will come across people who live their religion in a way that is probably holier than maybe the way that you live your religion in different ways. So in my life, for instance, I have quite a few Muslim friends, and one principle of Islam, one of the five pillars of Islam, is the importance of fasting during the month of Ramadan.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where Muslims around the world will fast from sunrise to sunset. And this act of fasting for about a month straight, you know, where they eat at night or, you know, outside of their fast. But it is an act of faith for them. And it's something that, as I've been able to witness my Muslim friends engage in, my own appreciation for fasting has grown. My testimony of fasting has grown because I've seen the faith that they've expressed, and it's challenged me and inspired me to try to live my own faith better. And so that's something that I felt holy envy towards, where I've seen something that's very valuable, that's commendable, that's good in other belief systems. And because of that, it's made me want to be a better member of my own faith tradition. And so you can use that holy envy to increase your own discipleship. And I think it's a very beautiful thing when you're able to recognize and practice that.
Those 3 points, who was it that said it, and where can people find it if they want to kind of reread what we've just spoken about?
His name is Christer Stendahl. He's written about it in various forums, but the place that I am getting the information from, the church has many resources on interfaith relations and whatnot. So there's one page in particular where you can read about some of the things that the church has been engaged in. It's on the church newsroom on the church website for that. And it's titled Interfaith Efforts of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It'll link you to a lot of different examples of talks, of different acts of interfaith service or things like that, dialogue that the church has engaged in. It's a really good resource for someone that's looking to get the kind of the 101 on how the church feels about interfaith. And, you know, spoiler alert, we're all for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that we really appreciate and we would love to be able to continue to foster. So,
and spoiler, yeah. Let's do more, please.
Yes, yes.
I'll get that link to that and put that up with the show notes for this particular episode. You can find it at theculturalhall.com. So what's next? You're home. You've been home now 7 days. You're with. Mm-hmm. You're out visiting your girlfriend. I assume that you've been set apart or released from your mission calling. So what's next?
Well, I do plan on returning to Arizona State in the fall. But other than that, to be honest, I'm trying to figure out my summer. You know, I'm trying to figure out whether I should do some schooling during that time as well, or get a job, where I should get a job, maybe both. You know, I have had to adapt pretty quickly to the change in plans. And so I'm still in the process of figuring that out. But I do have some pretty promising avenues that I'm currently exploring, and we'll just see what happens with it. But I am looking forward to getting back into school. I know that one's for sure.
It's kind of a whirlwind coming back, right?
Yes, yes.
What's been the most interesting thing, whether it's harder or easier or didn't expect it as you've come home?
Oh, well, adjusting to civilian life has been difficult in ways. I think one of the best ways to kind of demonstrate that is the other day I was downstairs in the living room, and my brother decided to go upstairs to his bedroom. And for a second, I freaked out because I felt like my companion had, you know, gone with, outside of sight and sound of myself, and so that I had to go follow him to the bedroom. So just remembering that yes, I am released, and so I don't have to follow all the same protocols as I did as an elder. That's taken a little bit of an adjustment. Mm-hmm. But you know, those moments have been funny. It's been a good time kind of adjusting.
Anything that you didn't expect?
One thing that I kind of fought, or I felt like I would never give into on the mission, is getting used to shaving every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was, and while I was obedient to that, you know, I wouldn't say it was, with the best attitude. I was kind of begrudging with that. But what was funny is on my last day in Armenia, I shaved again that morning, and you know, I kind of looked in the mirror and I was like, gosh dang it, you know, they broke me. Like, this feels normal now, like I'm fine with this. And so that was pretty funny. So yes, I'm in that habit now. We'll see if I can break it.
So you've continued to shave as you got home?
Yes, I have.
We ask everyone who steps into the Cultural Hall three questions, so I'll ask those of you right now. First of all, do you have a calling right now? And if so, what is it?
No, I don't have a calling. Before my mission, I was a Sunday school teacher for the 6 and 7 year olds.
Awesome. You like that younger, the primary?
Yeah, it was fun for sure.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or make one up, what would you pick?
Oof. Let's see. Do they still have gospel doctrine teacher? I'm not sure if that one got...
Yeah, it's still around. It's every other week.
Okay, cool. Well, you know, I would love to be able to get some type of like teaching position for adults in a church setting, whether that's something more traditional like a gospel doctrine teacher, or like you said, if I was able to make something up where I talk about, I don't know, some scholarly stuff, or I don't know, I'm able to nerd out a bit more. That would be interesting as well. Maybe something like church interfaith advocate or something that appeals to my passions.
I think that there's a need for something like that. That doesn't seem so far out there that I don't think that you couldn't appeal to the ward or to the stake and say,
yeah,
I feel passionate about this. Can we use my passions and my intelligence to be able to further the work?
Yeah, for sure.
I'll talk to the stake president. Don't worry about it.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. The last question we ask everyone who steps into the cultural hall is, what is your favorite part of your faith?
Ooh, one thing that made the difference for me in choosing to continue to be a Latter-day Saint and feeling like that was the path that I was meant to walk on is just the depth and the richness that I've been able to find in the restored gospel. For me, if I didn't feel like I was intellectually challenged and spiritually challenged too by being a member of the church, I think it'd be much harder for me to want to maintain activity or to be able to have a belief in the restored gospel. But the kind of rich intellectual tradition in the church, the rich history and theology, all facets of it, I've just been able to be enthralled by and dive into and seek to understand. And because of that, I feel like I'm a better human being because I'm a member of the church and because I've gone through and studied it like I have. I'm continually challenged in my discipleship, but I feel like it's a refining experience. And because of that, that's the part of my faith that I love the most, is that I don't feel like I need to be afraid to learn new things, that I can't ask questions, that I can't pursue truth in an open way. If I didn't feel that, I don't know if I would have stayed. Hmm. But I feel like I am called and exhorted as a Latter-day Saint to seek truth wherever it's found. And that's something that I hope to dedicate my life to in, you know, as lowly and imperfect a way as it surely is. It's something that I'm very deeply involved in.
Well, we hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, that if you're not healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat on the back row. We read.